Princesa Van Buren Hansen is a principal planner with the Minnesota Environmental Quality Board. She led the development of the EQB 2010 Minnesota Water Plan, setting a roadmap for the state's activities in ground and surface water protection, and is providing leadership on a number of state water sustainability efforts. And with that, I'll hand it right over to Princesa.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you very much for the opportunity to be here today. I'm happy to talk to you about a plan that was adopted by the EQB at the end of this last year. And so I don't forget to tell you, I do have copies of the report available for anyone who wants it today. It's in the poster room at the MGWA table. So yes, as Mindy says, stop by that table, check out the posters and the great MGWA information. In my presentation today, what I'll talk to you about a little bit is kind of the overview of what the EQB is and the charge under which we're operating. I'll go into a discussion of the State Water Plan and what it contains. I'll talk about how this plan can be applied through some examples. And then I'll talk to you about next steps, kind of where we are today and where we're moving in the future. First off, the Environmental Quality Board, for those of you who don't know, was a board that was created back in the 1970s. It brings together representatives, the commissioners actually, of 9 state agencies, 5 citizen members, and a representative of the governor's office. It was created with a recognition that environmental activities take place in a number of agencies, these 9 different groups, for a good reason. But when it comes to many of our issues, what we really need to do is bring everyone together at the table to talk about our plans moving forward, how to coordinate and to move forward efficiently, how to address things that are relevant today but ever-changing. And so the board was created, I think, with quite a bit of vision and foresight, saying that we needed the executive branch to coordinate, but also to bring in the public and the governor's office in these conversations. We're also very active with environmental review and responding to a whole series of different environmental issues. The EQB has been very active in the water arena in recent years, going back to early and mid-2000s. Back in about 2005, the governor's office recognized that water issues were rising in the state, that we were running into problems and conflicts over surface water, groundwater, and the implications of quality degradation. And so the governor's office charged the EQB to work with the DNR to first prepare this use of Minnesota's renewable water resources, looking at the availability of our water resources to meet both our needs today and in the future. Upon release of this report, there was a lot of interest in continuing that conversation, and so the EQB was charged to move forward, not to just look at some of the water allocation decisions, but to look at cumulative potential effects, to put decision-making in a broader context, both for today and also in the future, as we have other emerging issues, threats, climate change, and things affecting our water environment. So in terms of the EQB State Water Plan, the EQB has been charged. Looks like it's working. In terms of our charge, we have a long history, again, for this 10-year planning effort. It goes back to the 1970s. So this is actually our fourth 10-year state water planning effort. We have plans going back to 1979, 1991, 2000, and 2010. And when you actually look at the acknowledgments to each of these reports, you'll notice a lot of people in the room have been active one way or the other over the years. But looking back over these 4 reports and everything that's gone on since the 70s, what you see is there have been a lot of planning efforts. And I think we all share some frustrations over planning documents where they may seem engaging and interesting at the time, but they don't really get used as well as they could. And I think looking at it, what we see is we need to work together to make them effectively implemented. What that means is we need to have a common goal, a common definition, and then we need to engage at all levels. We need to engage with landowners, stakeholders, environmental groups, local governments, state and federal governments, research institutions, and the legislature. And so what I really want to call attention is looking back over this history, not just for the EQB, but for others as well, it's the working together piece that's so key. And with all of it, as we were reflecting in preparation of this plan, we also recognize that we're responsible to people today, but we're also responsible to future generations. So the goals of the report. First, we're to define a vision for the future. We recognize that our state lacked a clear and defined vision of where we wanted to go. And so one of our key goals was to define that so we could work together behind that definition so that our combined actions could provide the greatest benefits. I think it's a little temperamental here. We also looked at the fact that we wanted to design a broad and adaptive framework. Again, looking back at what's worked well in the past and what hasn't, what we decided to do is, because we're working with 9 different agencies, because we're working with local, state, and federal government, we wanted to design a framework that could be applicable to all. And we also wanted something that could be changing over the coming 10 years, responding to issues that we didn't foresee yet today. And so we decided the best way to approach that was to come up with something that could be broad, but then could be defined specifically for each different group's specific needs. And I'll talk more about that today. We also recognized that as the executive branch, that we needed to articulate our state strategies to achieve sustainable water management. In recent years, thanks to the Clean Water Legacy Act, as well as the Land and Legacy Amendment, there's been a ramping up of efforts on the part of the state government and others as well. And as those things have been changing, we really needed to bring that information together and communicate to the public, to legislators, and each other what we're doing and how we're responding. The other thing is, you'll hear from Dr. Swackhammer later today, we recognize at the same time the University of Minnesota was also charged to be moving forward with the process. So I know we get questions all the time. We've got a state water plan. We've got a water sustainability framework. You know, what's the difference? How do they complement, et cetera? So I'm hoping that by the end of this morning, you'll have a much better appreciation for those differences. Again, the EQB report was the executive branch response to statute created in the 70s saying, we need the executive branch environmental agencies to get together to look at our water policies, our programs, and our needs, and to form a plan for the next 10 years with a vision far into the future of how we're moving in that direction. Deb will talk about her framework, process, and what the legislature charged the university to do in bringing other stakeholders together with a slightly different goal. But at the same time, I think what you'll find is a lot of concurrence in the two plans. So I think it tells us that we're listening, we're learning, and we're responding in a reasonable manner. So the report is actually broken into 3 main sections. The first part of the report reflects on the past. In order to move forward, sometimes we need to look to the past to see what we can learn. And we bring together in this first part of the report summaries of where we've been. What we see is actually we've known a lot over time. There's some areas we've made significant progress, and then there's other areas that some of the same barriers still remain. And I think our challenge is to try to tackle those as much as we can. Also in this first part of the report, we look back at the last 10 years. So compared to the 2000 plan, where are we today? And what we found is actually the past 10 years, have been a pretty exciting time in water. There have been some things that we defined as transformational milestones. And those are issues or events that have really kind of changed our landscape. They've driven things forward. Things that we put in this category include climate change, population growth, hypoxia in the Gulf of Mexico, TMDLs and impaired waters. You know, 10 years ago, the public didn't know what TMDLs or impaired waters were, but now you can read about it in the Star Tribune, and you can read about how differing interest groups are getting together behind a common mission. Some things like endocrine active compounds and what we know about that, the 2006 Legacy Act, the 2008 Land and Water Legacy Amendment. Those were transformational things that affected Minnesota water resource professionals, where we are with our understanding today. The second part of the report evaluates the status of our water resources. So again, we have a lot of agencies in the area of water. So what this section does is it gives us a snapshot of where are we today. We combine information from 4 different reports that were produced for the state water plan. The first one, the PCA and the Department of Ag, looked at water quality trends and protection and prevention efforts. In the next part, the PCA looked at groundwater monitoring efforts. The DNR provided an assessment of water availability, both surface water and groundwater. And Met Council provided an update on the Metro water supply planning efforts. And we see, again, some of the progress made and some of the challenges and barriers that exist. So for a group of water resource professionals, I highly recommend you also look at that and read the appendices. I think you'll find some very interesting information there. Then the third part of the report is charting a roadmap for the future. And that's the real foundation. That's what I really want to leave you with today. And that's where we sat down and said, all right, as the executive branch, what are we going to do in the coming decade to make a difference, to respond to what we know we need to do? In that roadmap, we have 9 strategies that we've defined. Again, overarching strategies, but they're exactly what we need to be doing to advance the foundation, build upon what we've been doing, but to really move forward. Then with that, there's 7 implementation principles. They tell us how to put the strategies in place, again, with a focus on water sustainability being the goal. So again, I mentioned earlier that we wanted to be broad and adaptive with this. And so when we look at these strategies and these principles, what this really serves at is as an operating manual. So I hope that everybody in this room can learn from some of these things. Think about aspects in your job that you're doing well today and some areas where maybe you can grow a little or challenge yourself to move forward. Again, taking this information and kind of going through it to see where are some of the weaknesses, what do we need to be doing better? Again, looking at it as kind of an operating plan. In terms of the 9 strategies, and the first one looks at protection efforts. We all recognize that it's much easier to protect and preserve from depletion or degradation what we have today than to try to go in and restore or fix and change. And so with that, we know a lot more than we have in the past, and we also have new tools available to us today. So again, first off, starting with a focus on protection wherever possible. And very similar to that, if we promote wise and efficient use of water, then we won't be depleting or degrading to start with. Again, technology has made some significant advances here, as well as education, outreach, and just general information. We also recognize we can't do this alone. As the executive branch, we set a framework, we provide guidance, we do monitoring, but we really depend on local capacity, interest groups, stakeholders, and landowners to make a significant difference. And so we're really challenged that we need to engage that local capacity. We need to share the information we have, but we need to provide guidance and instruction on what others can do to help us all move toward this common vision. We also recognize we need to employ water resource management units. What we're talking about here is adaptive management, how we're learning over time. As Representative Torkelson mentioned, some of our impaired waters are just stream reaches. But instead of just monitoring water body or stream reach by stream reach, we're starting to look at watershed units. The MPC is implementing an intensive watershed monitoring plan, recognizing it's easier to address kind of the culmination of all the problems by looking at the larger scale and how things are interrelated versus just spot one time or one location by one location. In a very similar manner, when it comes to groundwater, over time the DNR has looked at kind of well by well monitoring. But again, realizing over time, as we've run into some conflicts in some areas, that while that worked in the past, it isn't the framework we need moving forward. Rather, we need to look at groundwater management areas and to see how various different users impact each other and how that groundwater interacts with the surface water. So we really need to look at how do we define the proper management unit to make successful decisions about the stressors and the responses. Our next strategy looks at collecting essential information. We have a lot of data that we've collected over time. We still always want more because there's gaps, but what we really need to do is we need to prioritize. Again, we don't have all the resources we want or what we need, so what we need to do is focus on the most significant gaps, define where they are, and come up with a strategy for addressing them over time. Also making sure that we're very cognizant to being as efficient as possible, working together as much as possible, and collecting it in very consistent manners so we can easily share and transfer data. Similarly, we need to make sure that those volumes of data that we do have are available to others. And we recognize that actually there's a series of different user groups. A lot of times technicians in the water resource arena know how to get access to the information they need. But sometimes when it comes to local government, other groups, industry, and so on, what they actually need is sometimes pre-processed data or data that's just easier to access. We need to be very cognizant of that and try to develop a system moving forward that is more transparent and easier for others to use. We also need to provide implementation tools. When we look at our water resources, groundwater and surface water, we realize a lot of times the changes need to take place on the land surface, either in practices or use or decision making and so on. And so the implementation tools we have available to us is a suite of tools. We have education, we have best management practices, we have incentives, we have regulation. So what we need to do is look at what tools are working and where we have gaps and we need to develop new tools or use a series of tools together. We also need a targeted approach. Again, Representative Torkelson talked about that. We've learned over time that oftentimes it's a smaller fraction of the landscape, say 20% of the landscape, that might be contributing, say, 80% of the problem. So instead of just treating our landscape uniformly, what we need to do is use the tools that we have to define those most vulnerable or highest risk areas. And lastly, we need a systematic approach for addressing emerging threats, whether that be endocrine active compounds, whether that be climate change, or whether that be groundwater infection that Representative Torkelson was talking about. We need a system where we can respond collectively in a similar process to get the information we need, to start making decisions, but then to create a framework that can bring in new information to improve the decisions. So those are kind of the 9 strategies. And I'm guessing that many of you see elements of these strategies in the work that you do and ways that you can maybe implement some of them a little bit more. So then how do we do that? And those are the overarching 7 principles. Well, first off, we need to optimize coordination. As things get leaner and as the challenges continue to increase, we recognize that we need to always actively seek to coordinate, to share information amongst each other, but then also to coordinate with the public, with the legislature, with interest groups. We also need to prioritize our resources. And those aren't just fiscal resources. It's how we prioritize our monitoring. It's how we prioritize our data collection and our restoration efforts. But it's also how we engage our stakeholders and when and how we do our community outreach and so on. When some activity is already taking place in a certain area, maybe we need to look for opportunities to piggyback on that and maximize the combined benefits of working together. We also recognize more and more that comprehensive land and water management are critical. Surface water and groundwater are really one resource. It's just where they are in the water cycle. Similarly, what takes place on the landscape or in the water has a direct connect to each other. So when we're looking at what we do, we need to always look at the bigger system and those interconnections. We also recognize a need for adaptive management. I think that's what we see in the past, you know, looking over the last decade. We have to make decisions today with the information we have today, but we need a system that can be robust. So as we learn more, we continue to incorporate that for better decision making. And sometimes making those changes and being adaptive can be hard, but we need to poise ourselves to be ready to do that and do it as well as we can. We also need to define goals and measures. We need to make sure that we're using the information we have today, the resources we have today, as effectively as possible. But I think even more than that, we're challenged by documenting our success. We need to prove that we're making trends in the right direction, that we're learning from what we're doing, and that we're on the track that the citizens, the public, ourselves want to be doing. We also need to focus on education and outreach. The fact that the amendment passed in 2008, I think, speaks volumes to the fact that citizens of Minnesota really value their water resources. And with that, they're entrusting us to try to set up a system that works so that in the future we have the groundwater and the surface water that we need to meet our needs, our economy, and our social values. And with that, we need to tell people what we need them to do, what we're doing, and what their role can be in helping us. And lastly, we need to unite behind this shared long-term vision, one in which water, both surface water and groundwater, are managed comprehensively, where we're looking at ecosystem needs as well as human needs, both today and in the future. So again, recognizing that for Minnesota to be strong and effective, we need to find a way to balance our social, economic, and environmental needs to try to find kind of that the right balance so that we can have a sustainable future. So in terms of 3 examples, I'd like to talk to you about the groundwater management area concept and how we can use these strategies and principles to move that forward. I'd also like to talk about contaminants of emerging concern and impaired waters. Here we have a map, and many of you have seen this before, but it looks at the capacity for groundwater use across the state. And what we see in this map is we go to the northeastern part of the state where we really have limited groundwater available, to the southeastern part of the state where we have many, many more aquifers, though they have some of the challenges of karst. I think what this shows you is the variability in the state. Then if we overlay that with the soil type, if we overlay precipitation, if we overlay land use, what you find is that Minnesota is a dynamic, heterogeneous state. One size fits all doesn't work. And so as the DNR is now moving forward with stakeholders and partners to define these groundwater management areas, they're looking to employ the right groundwater management units. But as they define them, it's with the recognition that the challenges across the state differ greatly. The landscape, the land use, is highly variable, and we need a system that can understand that. We also need to continue to optimize that coordination. Because again, going across the state, we don't have enough people to do all of this work. We need to use the resources that are there. We need to work with local capacity. We need to work with stakeholders and landowners to really define how we can preserve our groundwater from depletion and degradation. And again, this is a learning process, so we're really looking forward to applying adaptive management. How can we best, as we gain information, continue to refine the system? The goal in the groundwater management unit concept is recognizing that we need to probably start with some of the areas where there's greatest conflict, but when we have a system that's robust and working, we can hopefully be proactive in identifying future problems before they arise so they can be mitigated before we have a situation of conflict. In terms of contaminants of emerging concern, a lot of work's being done by the MPCA and the Department of Health with recent resources. And what we have here is a map of the state of Minnesota looking at surface water sampling locations that the MPCA is doing for some of these endocrine active compounds. There's a similar effort that they're doing for groundwater, but this is just kind of a visual representation. Again, it's an area that's an emerging threat that we don't have as good a grasp on as we wish that we did. And so we're focusing on collecting the essential information for decision-making, also focusing on making sure that that data is in the proper format, easily accessible, and ready to inform many different stakeholder groups. And then to help working together with the agencies, the Department of Health, and others to come up with a systematic way for addressing these concerns. And my last example is impaired waters. Here's a map of actually something that you're going to hear about later today. Andrew Streitz will be talking about this area. It's Little Rock Creek. It's in kind of west central Minnesota. But this is a map where there's a surface water impairment that they're finding to be caused by groundwater use. And so this here is an example of where we're going in terms of comprehensive land and water management, where we don't just have surface water specialists working on TMDLs, but we have groundwater specialists working directly with surface water people to map and model what's going on in the landscape, understanding that direct hydrologic connection, which, you know, this is kind of a new concept to actually a lot of legislators, media, landowners, and so on. It's not always intuitive, those direct connections, and why a groundwater change might be needed to impact positively a surface water feature. But again, the solution to this is focused on providing current implementation tools and really employing a targeted approach where we need to define exactly where is it that we need to make these changes to produce the outcome we desire. An example of some of these targeting and what we have today is LIDAR. I'm guessing most everyone in the room has heard about LIDAR data, but it's something that's now becoming accessible to us. And when you compare the figure on the left with a 3-meter resolution to the one on the right with a 30-meter resolution, it tells you how much better this tool can give us information about the landscape. So let's look at using this tool as an application. Here, the LIDAR data was used with a terrain analysis to help pinpoint on the watershed itself some of the most vulnerable areas where then the landowner can go in and really focus, oftentimes intuitively, but this can give you a broader scale focus on where the landscape is most sensitive to surface water runoff and erosion. So if we take it from just the field scale to a watershed scale, here too LIDAR data was used with terrain analysis to focus on where there is a direct hydrologic connection between the riparian area and the ditch. What this also again shows is this is less than 30% of the landscape, but these are the most critical areas. So now using these tools, we can much more easily and very quickly go into an area and focus our resources, focus our monitoring, focus our, you know, field scale evaluations. So I think what we see in this whole process over the last decade and longer is that adaptive management has been applied. We've gone from this sense of that we have this abundance of water. I mean, we're the land of 10,000 lakes, right? But over time, we're seeing a paradigm shift where we better understand that in some areas we really have limited resources. Our quality has really made it an impact so that quantity becomes a problem. So we've gone from a feeling of abundance to a recognition that we need management. We've gone from a time when surface water and groundwater were largely dealt with separately to recognizing it's a single resource and that we need to work well together. We've gone from also in the past where quantity and quality, just like surface water and groundwater, had different groups and different people and didn't always interact, to recognizing that they're directly connected. We've gone from a time of point-specific decision-making to one in which we understand that the best way to do it is with a systems-wide view. We've gone from stream reach and, you know, sort or well-by-well monitoring to watershed assessments and groundwater management assessments. So again, I think that recognition that quality, quantity, ecosystems, humans, societal needs, economy, quality of life all need to be tied together. So some of the strengths of the State Water Plan are first that it unifies state water activities. It's a document that educates people as to what the executive branch is doing. And instead of just looking at single programs, it brings them together to show the strengths of those programs working together. And I think this is important. This plan articulates a consensus of the executive branch and a commitment to moving forward in the coming decade in these areas. Again, there's a focus and development of this plan that promotes this dynamic, adaptive approach to water management. It says that we need to use this information today, but then also reevaluate in 1 year, in 5 years, to see where we are and how we can continue to improve. So some of the next steps that we're working on. First, we're working with the various agencies to actually apply these concepts within their group. We're actually working on kind of building a guide, a worksheet and workbook to putting this operating plan in place so that each of the different water functions of the agencies can use this information to improve the work they're doing. Next, this provides us a foundation and a framework whereby the agencies can be responsive to Clean Water Fund priorities. We also recognize that this provides us a foundation whereby we can look at the university framework and other documents and the recommendations of them and try to implement them and integrate them in the work that we do. And lastly, we've been called to continue to work with this document and work together to measure progress and to make sure that we are implementing it well, that we're on the right track with trends in the direction that we want to be going. So with that, I thank you very much for your time this morning, and I'd be happy to answer a few questions.
From the public participation process, I understand you have used the web this time to public notice it, and I'm just curious to know how the process worked out.
Yes. Well, a couple of things to that. Through all the agency activities in the last few years, we've actually had a number of different stakeholder processes that also formed a foundation to the work we did. And then we drafted the document and we did release the draft on the web. We had it available for everybody. We had it open for a one-month public comment period. And then we received feedback back in a number of different mechanisms. So I think that along the way, that we received a lot of interest from many different citizens and stakeholder groups. And we received a series of comments. I think that in terms of the comments, some were specific to certain areas, and we tried to really respond to that. I think that some of the comments were positive in the direction that we're going, and some citizens and people just feel a little frustrated that we're not moving faster, and I think we all feel that in some ways ourselves. And so from our perspective, the feedback was positive, that people had the chance, that, you know, that public comment period to respond. We invited them to come to the EQB meeting and speak as well.
Yeah, thank you for your presentation. One of the things you talked about was the need for pre-processed information that's easy for people to use. And I understand the need for that. I also can consider some of the difficulties that may evolve around that. For example, if someone makes a decision about a site-specific issue based on a map that's statewide or something. So I'm wondering if you could just give us an example of where or how that's being done well and that we might use to think about that?
It's a very good question. We're really, I think, early in the stages of trying to address that in many ways. You know, the state's really exploring how we can best share data, collect data, and make it available. But what we recognize with that is similar to what Representative Torkelson spoke about, is the challenge of getting good information, say, to local water planning, to county-level management, and so on. So some examples of that are to get good information, say, about groundwater vulnerability and water quality problems and so on to local planning so that as someone is looking to site industry or site expansion and growth, they have better information about where groundwater is limiting, where water quality problems exist, where some of those surface water impacts may take place. And so, again, I think we're on the early stage of just being responsible to getting good, solid information out there in a way that it can be used by some of these groups.
I believe I heard the term endocrine active compounds. Is that a euphemism for endocrine disruptors?
Yes, they're very, very similar. We use them interchangeably, I guess. But the endocrine active compounds, endocrine disruptive compounds, yes.
I'd also make, this might be nitpicking, but it says endocrine active compounds. We also have endocrine active elements. My wife and I live in the Iron Range, a lot of minerals, I believe, arsenic, cadmium, manganese would be elements that would be also active. Thank you.
Thank you.
One more half question.
Thanks for the work, and it really does reflect a lot of the work that people do here. I want administrative needs you're talking about, though, require legislative appropriation. And talk to me about your adaptive management to the new budget, to the new politics. You have all new members on the EQB that weren't involved in any of this, and a whole new budget paradigm. So how are you adapting?
It certainly does. Well, it's not over till it's over, but we have a lot of consistency actually within the members in the agencies, and part of our responsibility through these working groups is to continue to work together but also educate our new EQB commissioners. We also have consistency in the EQB in that we have the same five citizen members still on board. I think that this framework really calls us to prioritize, to work as efficiently and coordinated as we can. And so we will, in the coming decade, face a number of budget challenges and a number of shifting things as it relates to budget priorities. And as frustrating as that might be sometimes, our responsibility is to do the best we can to be responsive. And hopefully we can collect some really good new information and make some significant strides. I think the challenge each of us faces here today is we know with this amendment, we were given 25 years, we have 23 left. In order to really be different at the end of that time period, we need to be transformational. We need to look for some really good opportunities to do things differently. Thank you.